I'm Ginny Bouvier, and I'm a senior program officer here in the Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program at the U.S. Institute of Peace. On behalf of USIP, I'd like to welcome you here for the sixth in our series of Senior Fellow Project Reports, and I invite you, if you haven't already done so, to pick up a schedule on the table outside of the remaining project reports. Today, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Pierre Hazan, who will discuss his project report on a framework for evaluating transitional justice. His working paper, too, can be found on the table outside. After nearly a generation of efforts to consolidate mechanisms to achieve some sort of accountability and justice for victims of crimes against humanity, Pierre and others are now on the cutting edge of critical thinking about how to evaluate these mechanisms, especially tribunals and truth commissions. Mr. Hazan's project on transitional justice contributes to a developing body of work on that subject that USIP has supported, including Neil Kritz's three-volume series, Transitional Justice, How Emerging Democracies Reckon with Former Regimes, USIP's report on the Iraqi Special Tribunal, Judy Barsalo's Working Group on Memory and Social Reconstruction, and her recent conference report, Trauma and Transitional Justice in Divided Societies, former senior fellow Michael Hartman's work and report on the role of international judges and prosecutors in Kosovo, and former senior fellow Rosalind Shaw's report, Forgive and Forget, Rethinking Memory in Sierra Leone's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, to name just a few. Mr. Hazan brings to his task a broad range of experiences that inform his analysis and equip him to take on this project. A Swiss journalist, for nearly 15 years, he was UN correspondent for the French newspaper Libération and the Swiss daily Le Temps. In this capacity, he covered numerous international crises, including those in Afghanistan, the Balkans, the Great Lakes region of Africa, the Middle East, and the Sudan. Pierre Hazan is author of Justice in a Time of War, The True Story Behind the International Criminal Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia, and The Victim's Guide to the International Criminal Court for Reporters Without Borders. He's produced four television documentaries, including Rwanda, Justice Taken Hostage, and The Hunt for Dictators, nominated for the Pierre Alain Donnier Prize for TV Documentaries. Pierre is a founding member of the International Film Festival on Human Rights in Geneva, a researcher for the Swiss National Scientific Foundation on International Criminal Justice at Geneva University, and he was a fellow at Harvard Law School last year. He holds a master's degree in strategic studies from Aberdeen University and is currently ABD for a PhD in political science at Geneva University. In addition to the book manuscript he's preparing on transitional justice in the post-9/11 era, Pierre Hazan has also completed a draft of a USIP special report on the Moroccan Truth Commission, which will be forthcoming later this month. He served as a consultant, expert, or panelist for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva, the Swiss Consulate, and the International Committee of the Red Cross. We're delighted to have Pierre with us, and we look forward to an informative presentation. Today's talk and the working paper he prepared are sure to generate a lively discussion, and we look forward to your contributions around the table as well. Before turning over the podium, I'd like to thank Eric Smucker, a research assistant that worked with Pierre and helped in organizing this event today, and currently a doctoral student at Georgetown University. Finally, I would ask that you please turn off your cell phones and any other electronic devices you have that might interfere with the microphones and with the event itself. And now, also, the event is being recorded live and will be available on the USIP website at www.usip.org. Probably later this week. So I'll turn it over to Pierre.
Well, thanks so much, Ginny, for these kind words. Hello, everyone. Well, I couldn't start speaking without thanking Ginny, all the people from the Fellows Program, and John and Eric and other people as well, obviously. Thanks for all of you to have come here and to speak about an important subject, I believe, evaluation of transitional justice mechanisms. Maybe I will tell you very briefly how I got involved. As a diplomatic correspondent in Geneva, I could see the beginning of the establishment of a tribunal on former Yugoslavia. And I was also covering the events on the ground. So when I was preparing this book, Justice in the Time of War, I went to Bosnia, and I remember very vividly meeting a man who testified in front of the ICTY. And he lost all his family. And I remember it was in a small village in central Bosnia. And he had only his grandchild, who was 3 years old at the time. And he told me, if there is no justice for my family, then I will teach my grandchild to seek justice in 20 years' time. And I was listening to this man, and in my mind, there was other memories which were coming back to me. And this other memory was in particular one from Roland Dumas. Roland Dumas was the French foreign minister and the architect of the ICTY, of the International Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia. That's the man who went to the Security Council and basically, well, established with the help of the other member of the Security Council, the Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia, which in turn generated the whole process of judicial movement that we know with the ICTR, with the ICC, and so forth. And when I met Roland Dumas, he told me, you know, basically, I didn't want to create any institution. I was afraid to be accused, to be considered as an accomplice of Serbs' war crimes, because the French at the time were very close to the Serbian authorities, to the Serbian government. So basically, and I will very quickly read you just one line to give you a flavor of the cynical approach, this very realist approach of this French minister who was the architect of the tribunal. I didn't want to appear as accomplices to war crimes that were still being committed at the time. So basically, he created the tribunal as a kind of PR exercise, first to appease the public opinion, but also to, as a kind of preventive diplomacy, not for not being one day accused of to be an accomplice of war crimes. So you can see that there is sometimes irony in history, and ideas have consequences. And to come back to this old man who was talking to me, watching his grandchild, who was called Johnny, and who must be 10 today, I couldn't stop thinking about this huge disconnect between political realities and huge, huge expectations on the ground. So ideas have consequences, and we do need to care about transitional justice, because we have to think that what in 20 years' time this little journey would think and act in many years. So maybe we need to care, and I will give you some reasons. One of them is the fact that these mechanisms of transitional justice became almost part of an automatic response of the international community. Since 1989, there have been more than 30 truth commissions in various continents. Financially, they are it costs quite a lot of money. The only UN ad hoc tribunals, they cost more than 15% of the UN ordinary budget. So it's significant symbolically, significant financially, and significant politically. And, of course, there is these mechanisms, these institutions are key to implement and create new norms and to enhance regional security and stability. So if you are looking for reasons to care, there are quite a few here. But in the same time, as the cynicism of Roland Dumas reminded us, we shouldn't be cynical. We should be also very careful. This tool can be politically manipulated by various parties. They can be distorted. They can be ineffective. And if it happens, then the level of expectation of a population would have been raised and then smashed, which would create, in turn, political problems. Now, I would like, during our little talk, I would like to focus just on a few mechanisms. So, truth commissions, criminal tribunals, either hybrid or international, public apologies, and reparations. How do they work? First of all, I have to say, and we, I think everyone, there is a consensus about that, it is to know how they work, we have to evaluate them. But the problem which appears immediately is how you do that. And before going to that very question, which is the core of our discussion, and I'm looking forward to our exchange of views, I would like just to point out the difficulties, because the obstacles are very real. One obstacle, obviously, is how do you isolate a variable? How do you measure, for instance, the effect of a truth commission in a process of democratization? Second, it's the vagueness of a concept. What is reconciliation? What is justice? What is transition? When does it stop? When does it start? So we are using ambiguous, very general concepts. Third is measuring deterrence. As we all know, deterrence is predictive. Therefore, it's very difficult to assess. So is it impossible to evaluate? I think it's not, but I think we need to be very careful. Once again, the obstacles to evaluate are real, but the message is simple. In the name of social reconstruction, regional stability, international security, peaceful coexistence, which are at stake, it's very important to find some kind of measure. But how to do that? How is it possible? I would like with you to use two sets of criteria. First, a time frame. Second, 10 indicators. Let's go to the time frame. I elaborated a temporal axis because transitional justice mechanism varies through time. If we think about the Nuremberg trials and its effects in Germany, we can very quickly realize that it has become really effective maybe 20 years after it has closed its doors. So basically, the effect of transitional justice mechanism is on time. Time is a crucial element. And I distinguished here four different periods. First, there is the armed conflict. Obviously, when Karadzic or Mladic are in power in 93, 94, 95 in Bosnia and Republika Srpska, it's very difficult for the ICTY to be very effective. So the level of expectation should be dealt accordingly. Then there is the immediate post-conflict period. And here, sometimes some people, some war criminals might have been indicted, but maybe not all of them. Some might be in power. Some are not arrested. And the criminal networks sometimes remain very powerful. And here again, we have to assess the evaluation of the transitional justice mechanism according to this time frame. Then there is the medium term. Usually, it's when the transitional justice mechanisms are the most efficient because the criminal networks, the warlords, they have been weakened. The society is changing. There are new priorities. And at that time, we can see that transitional justice can be quite effective. If we think, basically, to take the same example of the ICTY, it is during that very period that almost 90% of the indictees have been effectively arrested. Then there is the long-term perspective, which is basically a generational change. It means that there are totally new people who are in power. They have no memory. Some of them have little memories of the past. They are not linked to direct interests. So here again, I'd just like to emphasize the crucial dimension of time. Now, I would like to talk briefly about the 10 indicators which I use. Three of them are focused on tribunals. Three others are focused on TRCs, and four are common indicators to tribunals and TRCs. Okay. So first one, it's on tribunal. It's the penal effectiveness of criminal justice mechanism. What do I mean? It's very simple. Who has been arrested? Are they small or big fish? From one camp or many camps? What is the level of cooperation of different states? The P5, the big powers, but also regional actors. Are they ready to provide crucial evidence to build an indictment? Are they ready to arrest the people? To what degree the mandate of a tribunal has been fulfilled? And if, to take an example, if we think about the ICTR, the International Tribunal for Rwanda, we can quickly realize that people from one side, the people who have committed the genocide, some at least, have been arrested, but there haven't been any indictments so far from people of the other side who have committed crimes against humanity and war crimes in retaliation of a genocide. Though the mandate of a tribunal given by the Security Council was to address these two type of crimes, and it hasn't been able to do so for maybe political reasons. That's the first indicator, and we can see that we have pretty good factors in order to evaluate the effectiveness. The second factor, I call it with a bit of provocation, impact of short trials. Basically, justice, and there is a say in English, I think, which basically said justice must be not only done, but seen to be done. Basically, it's a question of perception. You can have a great tribunal, but if no one knows about it, it has no value. I mean, that type of tribunal exists only for the pedagogic element. So to which extent a tribunal, an international or a hybrid tribunal, is able to put its message across? How effective will be its message within the society? And here again, we can think about the ICTY. It's very simple. It's not effective. Maybe partially in Bosnia, but all the polls demonstrated that in Serbia and in Croatia, maybe 70, maybe 80% of the population has still a very negative perception of a tribunal. Regardless of the value of a tribunal, which is very striking, is that the tribunal was more interested to have its message across to the Western public opinion, but never really think until very recently about outreach program. And that's why it has failed on that point, which is a very important point. Then there is a third indicator, the deterrence. Deterrence, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, it's quite difficult to measure. But in the same time, I do think it's possible. To take the same example of former Yugoslavia, when the tribunal has been established, the Blue Helmets commanders and diplomats and other people were able to report that that the belligerents were quite concerned to be indicted, and they changed their behavior. So the deterrence effect actually worked until the day the belligerents realized that this institution had no real truth and no real willingness to indict anyone at the time. So, as you know, it's in these conditions that happened Srebrenica, because the worst crimes against humanity committed since World War II happened 2 years after the ICTY has been established. I mean, it was a total failure of deterrence. It shows also that this tribunal could be in certain conditions effective, but in other conditions could just send the opposite message, because the people are sure to get away with it if this tribunal are not perceived as doing the job. So basically what I'm trying to say, we can have some indication how deterrence work. Now, we're talking now about truth commission indicators. The first one is factual truth. What is factual truth? It's basically the establishment of facts. If a widow would like to locate the remains of her husband, would a truth commission be able to help her in doing so, and in also alleviate her grief? To which extent a commission will have the political will to establish the the nature of the crimes and the circumstances it happens? Will it have subpoena powers? Will it have the means to carry this task? To which extent state organs, military, police, other state organs will cooperate with the truth commissions? Here again, we can have pretty clear factors to evaluate the success or the failure of factual truth. Now, turning to dialogical truth, it's basically dialogical truth, it's the social truth. It's how a society changes when it receives information about its past through truth commissions. Are the media and the different groups changing their views? How the different segmented memories evolve and coexist? Is a new narrative being written? Here again, I think we can find a set of factors which will help us to find some understanding about how to evaluate that indicator. Third, recommendations. Truth commissions basically are done also not only to clarify the past, but to give a social momentum, to bring changes, to bring institutional reforms, to bring political reforms. And one good way to do that is the final report. Usually the final report, well, I put in parentheses usually, a final report could be a great place to propose changes, institutional changes, political reforms. But very often, we can see that many truth commissions don't write any final report, or if there is a final report, there is no recommendation. And when there are recommendations and they are good, most of the time they are not implemented. So here again, we can evaluate to which extent this very crucial task of a truth commission, a potential task, has been fulfilled or not fulfilled. Now, turning to the common indicators, to truth commission and tribunals, there are quite a few. There is the therapeutic effect. Basically, truth commission, tribunals. One of the reasons they have been put in place is to, and I use the usual terminology, to heal a society, to heal the victims. But is it really working? Well, first of all, you can say that impunity creates insecurity, creates anguish, creates pain. But at the same time, if we think about it, the therapeutic effect is not granted at all. First, there is physical risk involved. A lot of people who have testified, well, some of them actually have been killed because they put their life in danger, their life has been threatened. A lot of others were obliged to quit the area they were living previously because it was just becoming too dangerous. And this physical risk obviously impinged on their psychological and the therapeutic effects. The second dimension is the risk of re-traumatization. Imagine that during a truth commission, someone is confronted to his or her perpetrator. It might be very difficult indeed to cope in that situation, especially if the person is very vulnerable. And moreover, in a tribunal, cross-examination could be very difficult to handle, to the point where the former prosecutor of the STR and the present, and she's still the prosecutor of the ICTY, Carla Del Ponte, said that cross-examination is an instrument of torture. Maybe it's going to be maybe too far, but obviously it's going too far. But in the same time, I have in mind very strong memories of a woman which has been raped many times and was and testified in front of the ICTR, and the judges were thinking about something else, were laughing, and at the same time they were also laughing because the questions of the lawyer were just almost insulting to the point it was shocking and becoming absurd. also cross-examination could be quite nasty. And we can also think about Milosevic, because Milosevic, as he has acted as his own lawyer, was able to cross-examine a lot of people. Then imagine you have been a victim and you are suddenly, and you are almost illiterate, you come from a very poor region, and suddenly you have in front of you someone who almost incarnates the law and cross-examine you. It's very difficult to handle as a situation. Here again, I think we need to evaluate how it is done. Then there is the effectiveness of public apologies. Basically, since 15 years, it has almost become a fashion in politics to apologize. A lot, head of state, prime minister, institutions. It could be, I think, a very good social tool, but sometimes it's not. So here again, we need to find some indicators to see how it is done effectively or not. It's time, it is location, it's words, must be perceived as sincere. When, for instance, I give you two very brief examples. When President Clinton apologized for slavery in Uganda, maybe it was not the right country because Uganda was not part of the Atlantic slave trade, and it was not actually the right moment. And the effect was very limited because in Africa it didn't touch at the time the right chords, because maybe also the location it was said, and here I think it has very little effect. If we take another example, we can think about the German Chancellor, Willy Brandt, when he kneeled in front of the memorial of Ghetto Verso Ghetto. I think it was quite a surprise at the time, and it was perceived as extremely sincere. And I think that a lot of people changed their perception about Germany just because of that symbolic act, which was maybe much more important than financial reparations. So you can see here again that we can assess indicator, public apologies. And then there is the question of effectiveness of reparations. That's a very difficult indicator to assess because here we have a multiplicity of actors and they are very diverse with very diverse interests. On the one hand, you have victims, and the victims are everything except monolithic. On the one hand, you have some victims who will consider that to receive money is basically blood money. And on the other side, you have victims who will just think that that they want money, but they will think that any amount of money will be insufficient compared to the loss of someone close to them. On the other hand, you have this first group, which is very diverse. Then you have people who are competing in a new society for education, for other priorities, for rebuilding the state, for infrastructure. Then you have other people or institutions who might be linked to the crimes. You can think about sometimes the military or the police and could feel threatened by this process of reparations. So here again, we can see that we need to take into account not only the needs of the victims, which are very important, but the needs of a variety of actors. And then there is the social impact. Social impact is what? Is the building of a common narrative. It's the process of memorialization, writing new textbooks, but it's not only that. For me, it's also the social and political dynamic engineered for changes in the society. It is reform, it is trust, it is peaceful coexistence. So here again, we can have pretty good factors to evaluate to which extent it has been done or not done. So now we have our time frame, our 10 indicators. And I think there are indeed some political risks about not only evaluation, but about transitional justice and opportunities. So risks. I think, as I mentioned earlier, the level of expectation within a society can increase dramatically when a transitional justice mechanism has been introduced, because people are waiting for it. And here again, I'm thinking about the first story I was telling you about this little Johnny, and who might be, in 10 years' time, who will be 20. Will he seek revenge or not revenge? Will the people in a society feel cheated if there is no result? Yes. If there is no factual truth, no dialogical truth, no apology, no reparation, no reforms, there will be a counterproductive effect to this traditional justice mechanism, which will be translated into a political backlash and a social polarization. On the other hand, you can have also opportunities. It can create an atmosphere for non-repetition of crimes, democratization, human rights, state of law, social reconstruction. So we can see that we do need, and that's my conclusion, we do need to have some level of, we do need to have evaluation in order to have a clear understanding how these mechanisms work, to prevent them being distorted or politically manipulated. Today, these instruments are part of an almost Pavlovian automatic response of the international community. It became almost like a first aid kit, but there is no quick fix solution. And so if we want them to work, the process of evaluation is indeed crucial. And because not only this evaluation can lead also to an awareness among the people who are conceiving and using these mechanisms. And in doing so, maybe the question of stability and peaceful coexistence will be better addressed. Thank you, and now I'm looking forward to hear you.
I want to applaud your courage for taking this task on, because it's really an incredibly difficult and complex task. I'm going to start off with one question, then we'll open it up for the floor. And I guess my first question is, who gets to evaluate? You're developing these criteria, presumably from the perspective of perhaps an international organization that might be considering funding one of these organizations, and they want to know, is their money going to be well used? And I guess my question is, who gets to determine if it's successful or not? Are the victims the ones who would evaluate whether justice has been served? Are the people in power? Is there a broader way of getting that kind of feedback from the community that the mechanism is supposed to serve? Maybe if you could just reflect a little bit on that question.
It's a very broad question. On the one hand, you have some actors. You have the UN, which is very involved in this mechanism. You have the ICTJ, the International Center of Transitional Justice of this world, who are very involved. You have other international NGOs or institutions. But you have also the local actors who are very involved, the local NGOs, associations of victims, and churches, trade unions, political parties, according to the situation. So you have a lot of different actors. And I think it's obviously very important to take into account not only the fact that this money should be used accordingly, according to a set of standards, which is almost a Western conception of what is right and not right, but also to address truly the needs of the people on the ground. And you need, obviously, I believe, to go beyond the obvious answer or the usual suspects, where you will find some kind of answer you can already predict. But that's why I try to give some elements how we can identify, and not only to listen to some people, but, well, as you mentioned earlier, I just came back, I just finished a report on the Moroccan Truth Commission. And it's quite clear to see that the commission, for certain things, has not been very effective. It didn't have any subpoena power. It didn't have the mean to investigate a lot of very sensitive issues. And you can see it very clearly, and even you don't need to go there to do that. I mean, just you go through the final report, you see that a lot of sensitive political cases, there is just no light about it. So here again, with these indicators, I think which needs to be refined and operationalized. I think we can elaborate certain operational tools to answer your question.
I see one in the back. If you could identify yourself, please, and perhaps state.
From USIP. My work has been with the truth commissions in Salvador and Guatemala. But a critical issue was naming. And I'd like you to address the effectiveness of naming, which occurred in Salvador and did not occur in Guatemala, in approaching your criteria of the factual truth and the dialogical truth.
You're right. And here, again, we need to, I think, to introduce another parameter, which is the time dimension. It is, and there is, on the one hand, you have to have a realist approach. You need to have a clear reading of a balance of forces. What can you, are you able to go for naming? Obviously, I would imagine that naming is a better solution because people will feel that you can address really what happened. If not, it will be still very vague. But in the same time, we have to take into account the degree of democracy of a society. And I guess more we are close to the crimes of the past, more it will be difficult to name the people because there are still some of them are in power or very close to the power. So there will be a lot of things at stake. So I guess to answer to your question, we need to the best case obviously is the naming, because the naming will change not only the factual truth, but the factual truth will change the dialogical truth. It will create a new atmosphere in the society. Clearly, to speak about Morocco, where I've been there not long ago, the fact that there was no naming was a big problem, because people think, well, it's just some kind of, well, some people thought it was just some kind of very superficial quality of truth and not going deep enough. So I guess that's my answer. I mean, the absence of names limits the dialogical truth and therefore limits the expectations of the population also.
Accept the fact that it wants to have a truth commission without outside pressures.
Imad, could you just identify yourself?
I'm sorry, Imad Harb with USIP. Why does a country go through it? How does a country decide that, yes, we're going to have a truth commission? Because there are a lot of countries that haven't had it yet.
I think it has something to do with, you have two ways to look at that. First, there is a process of internationalization and integration of norms, because it's becoming a fashion. And in order, if you create a truth commission, then you gain first legitimacy, the power know that internally it will create a new identity. It's part of a nation-building exercise. Second, it will create internationally the idea that this country is really breaking with its past. And it can bring additional symbolic, political, and sometimes economic benefits. So you have a lot of incentives to do so, to create a truth commission. And I think a lot of countries do understand that. That's why it's becoming more and more fashionable, and that's why also we need to be very careful that these instruments are not being distorted. And that's the potential gains are important, more the risk that they would be distorted are becoming important as well. Yeah.
Very interesting stuff here, thank you. Two questions. Trish Thompson on the Institute of Peace. The preceding question before you get into indicators is what are the goals, what are the ultimate goals that these efforts are trying to achieve? So I'd like your perspective on what you think the goals are, which ones you think are most important. And then the follow-on question is, you've identified categories of indicators. What's your thinking on how you actually develop measures, metrics, indicators that gauge whether or not you're achieving those goals consistent with the categories that you've identified?
Well, first question, maybe I will start with, by the second one. Well, we would need to go into the details of one example and to go very far, but I think let's take factual truth. It's what it's the example I was trying to give some factors inside that indicator. I mean, the question of credibility of a truth commission. How is it composed? Is it composed by one camp, or people from two different and opposed camp, former belligerents, or is it by wise men? So you have different types, and you will see how the level of credibility, the credibility factor, according to the selection. That's the first point. Then you will have the political will of a commission to touch sensitive issues. Then there is will be the question of naming. Then there will be the question of subpoena powers. Then there will be the definition of a mandate. Is it a broad mandate or not broad mandate? What is a victim? Is it in certain Latin American countries, the victim of torture were not considered as victims? I think it's in Chile. In other countries, it was different. So according to all that factors, you will, at the end of your analysis, you will have a pretty good idea of what kind of factual truth is being shaped. And in answering to that question, I forgot about the first one.
Goals.
Yeah, the goals is basically to bring some... I'm not naive. I think that it can bring some level of peaceful coexistence, but it's part of a big salad. There are obviously different components. What is the real willingness of different political parties to find a common agreement? What is the balance of power? What is the external pressure to impose some kind of peace deal? And in that general framework, if the rest of the international committee is ready to go for it and to support that, if the internal actors are mostly for it, if the negative forces are quite limited, then I think that type of institutions or mechanism can be effective politically, symbolically, and institutionally.
Two more USIP questions. Then if there's anybody not from USIP that would like to say anything, this is not a closed forum, so I would invite you to begin participating as well. Abdeslam?
Yeah, Abdeslam Magrawi, U.S. Institute of Peace. Thank you, Priya. Very interesting talk. I just have a basic question on the notion of transitional justice. What is it that makes it transitional, and is it in comparison to what? Do we fit all sorts of like issues like human rights, genocide, Holocaust, slavery, do they all fit in that category of justice? And that leads me to the second question. Was I think there is a bit of tension when we want to establish some kind of criteria, which is very laudable, to evaluate the process and the effectiveness of this traditional justice. However, when you talk about the importance of dialogical truth that is involved in how people perceive that commission, there is a cultural element that is very important. I mean, how do you draw on those cultural institutions to make, you know, choose acceptable, legitimate, and credible, but at the same time you have some universal criteria to measure progress? I see that there is tension there that you may have to think about.
Between culture and universality of principles?
For example, I mean, for in Morocco, for example, I mean, I think that the impact of the Truth Commission in Morocco was much more positive than I think you suggested in terms of, well, it was an audience, there were public hearings, it was the first time that something came out. It has symbolic importance that was, I think, very significant. But by the criteria of, well, how do you actually measure progress might not have been important.
Yeah. So first, the definition. When I started this presentation, one of the first things I mentioned was to stress the methodological difficulties, and there is a vagueness of a concept which is true. I mean, which is very problematic. I will be the last one to deny it. And today, a few years ago, the idea of transition, we knew what it was. Today, I'm not sure we know what it is. It's becoming almost a kind of, I think, politically, it's becoming a very effective tool for certain governments to say that they are in transition, because it brings benefit. Because they are in transition, it means that they can get away with many things. So we need to be aware, some countries you know very well, they are always in transition. And you don't know, I think, wait, it's been 10 years, now it's finished. No, we are still in transition. So there is a problem. And there is a problem to use certain concepts for reparations now and to apply it for things which happened generations ago, because they haven't really been addressed. And now we have a feeling that we have created some kind of tools and we can address everything with it. And I think we have also to recognize the limits of these tools. And there is a role for the politics and there is a role for traditional justice. And we need to be very clear about that. The second dimension, quickly on Morocco, I just wanted to point out that there have been strong limits on the factual truth. It doesn't mean that the work of a commission was useless or counterproductive. I think it's been very productive, actually. But I wanted, in the same time, to stress that, for instance, in one case, which is extremely important there, the Ben Barka case, you find more in the newspaper than in the summary report where there is nothing at all. So I just wanted to stress that point. Now, on the criteria, there is the question of culture. And my view, and could be, and I can understand that people would totally disagree with me, I would give little importance to culture. I think when we use, a lot of people use culture in order to disguise or to find an alibi to reduce the need for justice. Because they say, here we do things differently. It is very important. I mean, I'm just trying to think now very concretely to give you an example. In Morocco, it's very interesting to see that the king, when he asks, he's not asking for amnesty, he's asking for forgiveness. And so he places the commission in terms of religious terms, in spiritual terms, it's forgiveness, so it's almost a relation with God. And the people of a commission, the commissioners, didn't want to use the terms forgiveness, they're using the terms amnesty because they wanted to remain in the political sphere. So for me, culture, I would use it just with a lot of precautions. That's my feeling, but I can understand that a lot of people might think very differently.
Gerald?
Yeah, thank you. I have a question in three parts. I will make it very brief. The tribunals, they are not only supposed to have effect in the respective countries, but they are also supposed to promote a culture of respect for human rights globally. How do you assess these mechanisms have been effective in being a deterrent to abuses of human rights? That's one. But two, the international community is moving away from ad hoc tribunals to one common court, to which the U.S. is not committed. From previous practice, the ad hoc tribunals have been effective most of the time to the extent that the U.S. has exerted pressure on states to cooperate. How do you think the emerging international criminal justice system will, how effective will it be if the U.S. continues to wish to stay apart? And generally, how do you think this emerging international criminal justice system can it be made more effective? Mm.
Okay. The question of the culture of human rights is It's what I was trying to say in the beginning. It's very difficult to isolate a variable. How do you know that a truth commission or a tribunal would have been a key element in changing the norms and the standards in the society? And we can, I guess it would be possible to make some kind of link between positive changes if they happen and the work of a commission, but we should be very careful. But I guess a commission can contribute if other institutions also play their role and the political parties play their role. What I'm trying basically to say, I don't think a commission by itself could be very effective. And commission can be effective if it is part of a larger momentum of changes in a society. And then it can play a role. The second question is how effective the ICC can be. There are so many different sides of the answer. One of them is when we think about, Northern Uganda, you can say the ICC has been quite effective because it has indicted a few the chiefs of the Lord's Resistance Army. But in the same time, and it is surprising to me at least, that they didn't came with a plan how to arrest these people. So the indictments may be a good thing and could be a sign of effectiveness of a tribunal, but it can create new tensions within that society if they didn't think through how to arrest the people. So I just would like just to show you the complexity of that point. And then there is the question of the Americans, of the U.S. government. And, it's a great test for the rest of the world to see if we are able to do something without the Americans. I think we are put to the test. And will the Europeans play a major role? They have a means to do that? They will. And that's, for me, a very open question.
Dan? Can I just...
Please
invite the
share.
One non-USIP
yes,
questioner.
Yes. Hi, I'm Laurie King-Iranian, and I'm with the Arab Reform Initiative, and sort of have a little relationship to USIP because we're once a recipient of a grant that actually had to do with conflict resolution and transitional justice through Truth and Reconciliation commissions and processes of acknowledgement for the forgiveness and transformation in Lebanon. And after working on that for 5 years, I came to the conclusion that the truth and reconciliation dimension is obviously extremely necessary, but it's not sufficient. You have to have a legal dimension as well. And in Lebanon, that's really a big issue, and it'll be a bigger issue because in 2 weeks there will be the report of the Brammertz investigation into the killing of the former prime minister, Rafik Hariri, and that will probably open up all kinds of cans of worms, not only in Lebanon, but possibly in Syria and other places besides. So as far as approaching these things sensitively from a legal angle, you have to build up the framework within the countries to do that. And in Lebanon at present, the judiciary is really a mess. And I think there's some concern and tension in Lebanon that with the opening of the files of the Hariri killing, that the files from the long civil war between 75 and 90, which were all closed by a general amnesty law enacted by the parliament as their very first act as a legislature in, I guess it was 90 or 91. You have to have some kind of like, almost like a legal SWAT team, I think, to help people with these sorts of things. So that's one comment. And then the other thing is, I'm wondering if in the course of doing this research, and by the way, this was a really incredibly well-integrated presentation of a very complex issue or set of issues, if you've looked at the whole issue of universal jurisdiction for humanitarian crimes in national courts, which is also a mechanism that's been there since the Geneva Conventions were signed in 1949, and it exists in theory, but it's very rarely used in practice. And as the Economist magazine in London said in June of 2001, the Belgian who were doing universal jurisdiction in their court, they managed to convict in a pretty rapid and inexpensive fashion four Rwandans who were guilty of incinerating dozens of people. Two of these people who are now in jail in Belgium were actually nuns. But that worked really quickly and really well and didn't cost a lot of money, and everybody, I
First point, I mean, I can only agree with you. And here again, I emphasize more and more, I look at different various examples. A tribunal or commission cannot work effectively if it is not part of a broader momentum. It does not, well, in the same time, it has to be autonomous. It has to, but it can be effective only if a political framework is ready, if a social framework, if a legal framework is ready, and if there is a great expectation of a people. Otherwise, I don't believe it is effective. To a certain extent, we can think about the ICTR, the International Tribunal for Rwanda, and it hasn't been very effective because there haven't been any pressure. The level of expectations were extremely low. The people in Rwanda, they have a very negative view of it. And I have to say also that the ICTR also made a lot of mistakes and has been a dysfunction in a huge way. But even when he tried to correct his huge mistakes of the beginning, he was never submitted to the same kind of pressures as the ICTY. That's the first element. The second point is very interesting, is universal jurisdiction. It's just fascinating. And it's true, if we look at the 90s, we can see this amazing process of creating new norms or reinventing norms or using norms which existed but never have been put into action, like universal jurisdiction. And suddenly, when we think about the Belgium law, you know that everyone, 100% of the Belgium senators voted for it. I mean, there was no opposition from left to right. It was seen as a thing to do at the time. And I'm not talking here on political term. No one really foresee that it would be unmanageable, that everyone who could come to the Belgium court and say, listen, someone has killed, well, there have been a war crime in Tibet, and here in Africa, and here. And they never thought that it could happen to them because they were so sure that the world was going to the right direction, that more and more countries will create these new standards of norms, and therefore will be some kind of division of labors, but in the good countries. Well, it didn't happen that way. At the same time, I remember vividly, I followed one trial on universal jurisdiction in Switzerland, and it's quite surprising, because Switzerland, as you know, didn't have any war for five centuries. And you had this military tribunal judging an alleged war criminal from Bosnia. And the judges could not really understand what was happening because they didn't have a culture of war. They were trained to understand it was a question of 60 kilometers, 40 miles. And for the Swiss people, 40 miles is you take a train and you go from Lausanne to Geneva, 32 minutes. And there it was half a day. And it didn't match their expectation. They couldn't understand the complexity of the war, the different sides. So it was very difficult. So I just would like here to point out that sometimes it's not a cultural element, but it is difficult from an outside perspective to grasp the realities of war and to have an outside informed look. And today, I don't know, I think a lot of countries moved in favor of universal jurisdiction. Now they went back, sometimes because of the American pressures, sometimes because it is still very costly. In Switzerland, after what happened with this Bosnian alleged war criminal, there was a new trial with someone from Rwanda, and a part of the tribunal decided to go to Rwanda to better understand the situation. But it costs a lot of money. It's a question of allocation of resources at the end of the day. So here again, there are different elements.
Daniel Serwood from USIP. I'm going to make a comment more than ask a question, but I suspect it will raise a lot of questions, maybe about myself. It seems to me that the whole discussion of transitional justice, including tribunals and truth and reconciliation, has an implicit model attached to it. And that implicit model is that accountability of some sort is good for peace building. And that's how you get past these things. Have you thought at all about whether that model is true or not? You could cite many examples, and I don't want to be
sure.
I don't want to be perceived as advocating this, but there are examples. One I heard on the radio last night of the Cultural Revolution in China. There's been no truth, no accountability, and a rather large country is moving ahead, maybe to disaster, but moving ahead nevertheless. You can take examples from American history, treatment of the American Indians. Accountability has come very, very late, and certainly it's more truth than accountability. Nobody's being held accountable, really. The question is it really good for peace building? The second question I wanted to ask is whether it's right to put the tribunals and the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions anywhere near each other. Because to me, they're two completely different things. And I think this is true not only for me, but for almost everybody who's a victim of these situations as well. People want justice. They don't want truth and reconciliation. They especially don't want reconciliation. Those of us who work on Iraq today know how little the Iraqis want to talk about reconciliation. Zero is the answer. And, you know, I can sympathize. So are these mechanisms really of the same variety? This goes back to the question of purpose that Trish raised.
Mm-hmm.
Are we, I think, making them part of the same, seeing them in the same box, implicitly assumes that this model of accountability is good for peace building is correct. But I'm not 100% sure it is correct.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the people involved in a lot of these situations don't think it's a grand idea, even if the internationals do.
Yeah. Well, I think there is a very easy answer, I think, which would be to say, I don't know if it's good or not for peace. But what I can tell you is that everyone thinks it's good for peace, and we need to work from this assumption on. Well, basically, 32 commissions, how many tribunals, how many things happening? I mean, just it's a fact of life. It's a reality. Okay. The second point is, true China, true Spain, true Mozambique, this country didn't go through that type of mechanisms. But in the same, what I'm trying basically to say is now there is a change of expectations, a change of attitudes. I don't know if it's good or not, but I think it's just, once again, a reality. There might be some exceptions. And we know, for instance, in Afghanistan, it's quite interesting, that 80%, there is a very interesting report, A Call for Justice, which shows that 80% of the people want some kind of prosecution of the perpetrators. But because there is another political momentum, there is nothing happening. So that's on the first point. On your second point, I think, I will answer not only on the, I would like to answer on the very point you mentioned. If you think about France, for instance, after World War II, De Gaulle has said something very, very clearly. He said he wanted to prevent a film to be shown on TV. He said, it was about the collaboration of French during World War II. And he said, our country doesn't need truth. Our country needs national reconciliation. And national reconciliation and national unity. And that's it. And what we have seen is for 50 years, now we cannot open a French newspaper with that issue all the time. I mean, it's never finishing. So I don't believe in closure, but I think that it will alleviate, create a better atmosphere. And I can tell you very vividly, when the President Chirac in 1995 spoke in front of at the Veldiv and said that he acknowledges for the first time the responsibility of the French authorities in deporting the Jews, it changed the atmosphere in the country. And I think France hasn't yet coped with what happened in the colony and in Algeria, which was not a colony. And I think it's creating today a lot of tension. So I do believe these mechanisms are important. I don't know, and here again, I agree with you, I don't believe they can work for themselves. They are part of a bigger momentum. Otherwise, they will be just alibis. So it's necessary that they will be supported by a political will and a social momentum.
Okay, I've got three folks down on the dock right here, Judy, and then John and Neil. And is there anyone else who'd like to be? Roxanne and Paul. And then I think we'll probably be close to out of time. Judy.
Judy Barslow, I confess I tune in from USIP. First a comment and then a question. The comment is that it seems to me that there's an unacknowledged moral calculation at the very heart of this enterprise of holding of you know, proclaiming the truth and holding people accountable through truth commissions and tribunals. And it's a moral calculus that is not explicitly acknowledged, but suggests the complexity of trying to evaluate impact, which you're trying to explore here. And that is that, I mean, if the moral calculation is that it's okay to bring victims forward to tribunals or commissions and have them testify, even at the cost of their own psychic health, at, you know, for the greater good, you know, through the exposure of truth, through the holding, you know, someone accountable. And so it seems to me, this is, you know, a sort of general comment, but it seems to me that in trying to make this calculation about impact and effectiveness, one has to acknowledge this inherent tension that exists in some cases, not for all individual victims, but for many individual victims. I mean, some may feel vindicated somehow by testifying. The second is a question, and that is, I noticed that you really focused on two mechanisms that by and large are operated at the national level, or national / international level, tribunals and truth commissions. And yet there's a whole array of transitional justice mechanisms and processes now that are operated at the civil society level. And I wonder if anyone has, in thinking about evaluating impact, and thinking about those cases that are, say, less than satisfactory, for example, looking at the very limited mandate of the Chilean Truth Commission, which has been much commented upon, whether, in fact, there's a kind of inverse effect where when the function of a commission like that, which, at some level was extremely successful, it met its mandate fully, but its mandate was very limited, whether that provokes a civil society response which compensates for that, whether it has a sort of stimulating effect. Mm. And in Latin America, in cases where individual victims have not been named, we see a civil society response in the form of many virtual websites now that name victims and post their photographs and give their biographies and attempt to, introduce them into the public memory in a way that official processes did not. So has anyone actually tried to look at the civil society response to less than fully satisfactory national or international processes?
I totally agree with your two points. The first is it's what I spoke earlier about re-traumatization of some victims, or the fact that some of them will be put in physical risks. That's true. There is somehow a balance being struck between the therapeutic effect, if I can use a psychological term, for societies and for individuals. And sometimes there might be some tension. The second question is very true, and I think that's the most interesting factor. Basically, okay, a commission will accomplish what it can, but what is more interesting is what's happening in the society, and to which extent at one point the society will grasp, will integrate, will create a new dynamism, will digest. That's the social truth I was, the social truth, the ideological truth I talked about. And that's the most interesting factor, I think. And if we think about Morocco, what is really amazing, on the one hand, you have the public hearings, but suddenly, and there was no naming, but some people didn't feel quite right about that, and they organized unofficial public hearings where there was naming. So you can see that there was something official, but which was limited, but in the same time, it created a momentum which changed basically the rules which just have been set.
Answered my question partly so far, but I just want to push a little further. It seems another reason for asking questions about evaluating these truth commissions and tribunals and so forth is, of course, to look at their effectiveness, try to improve them and so forth, but it also gets to the heart of the question whether in any particular circumstances they really ought to be pursued, whether they are worth the expense, and so forth. And, of course, there are a lot of ways you can look at that question. And one of them would be comparing. You mentioned that there are 30 or 35 of these commissions that have been around, but, of course, there are scores more of conflicts that have existed in the past 100 years in which which these things could have been tried at one point or another. And it seems to me that comparison between cases where truth commissions have been implemented and have had impacts that can be measured, with cases in which they were not adopted or were considered and rejected, would be quite interesting. I'm wondering if you know of any work along those lines or had opportunity so far to reflect on that issue yourself. And related to that, I think your comments on the question of what conditions might need to be in play or present in a particular context in order to give you or any set of decision makers confidence that pursuing the option is a viable one. Every option has risks, but curious to reflect on that.
I don't know of any work done on that, but what is very interesting is the report I was mentioning earlier on Afghanistan, A Call for Justice, because 6,000 people have been have answered a lot of questions about that, and there's some proposals either to go for an international criminal tribunal or for a hybrid tribunal or with Sharia and a mixture of international law or with a truth commission or with amnesty, and that's the only work I know for sure. And maybe one from ICTJ about Uganda. And concerning Afghanistan, I think people wanted more specifically trials. Maybe also because trials is something very concrete and they know what it is. And maybe it's what Dan said earlier. I think they have a pretty good idea of what justice is about. And TRC is something of the social quality, which is still very uncertain, that's all I know.
Neil Kritz, USIP. Let me join in on thanking you for a really awesome, fascinating presentation. Sort of the other piece of Judy's question, Judy referenced the civil society mechanisms that take place below or separate from the mechanisms you're talking about. My question is more geared toward the mechanisms that take place in between. So you're talking about international tribunals on one hand and truth commissions, which except for El Salvador have not been international on the other, namely the other national mechanisms, national tribunals, national courts, national vetting and purge processes, which in terms of your criteria that you establish, it seems to me that common wisdom increasingly is do cost a lot less. They are more effective in terms of social reconstruction, both in terms of a sense sense of national ownership, and also in terms of direct institutional reform, which is one of your goals, because you're building up the court process locally for the long term, and investing the resources in that way, and in being more accessible in terms of your outreach concerns, and in terms of the vetting and purging, obviously, creating credible, both deterring in terms of taking people out of positions where those uses can occur, but also creating confidence, local confidence in democratic institutional reform. So in terms of sort of thinking through the whole package of how do you evaluate transitional justice mechanisms, I'm just curious what your current thinking is in terms of that piece of it, since it seems to me increasingly that's where things may be shifting.
You're right. I haven't done so because it's huge. Huge spectrum of other mechanisms. But you're right, I totally agree with you, but today there is a tendency to move away from international ad hoc tribunals that are too expensive. Then there is the ICC. There is also the fact that there are great hopes also in hybrid tribunals, and I think Sierra Leone has mixed records. We don't know about, I think Cambodia will see more quite soon, hopefully. But you're right, there are new mechanisms at the national level which will take more and more importance in the near future. And I think we need to pay attention, but other than that, I cannot say anything, really.
Roxanne?
Thanks, Pierre, for a very informative presentation. I've taken your framework a bit further to the means of verification for effectiveness. And you've talked about the goals and some of the measurable indicators, at least indicatively. And I wonder, how do we verify that the truth has been told in the TRC? And if you use a top-down approach, if you contemplate whether it's a top-down approach or a bottom-up approach, and whose truth is it that you're verifying with? And so that the means of verification are what interests me.
Yeah. You're right. I mean, it's very difficult to define truth, and I mean, it would have been pages and pages to, and we had even a discussion to put it in brackets or not. Basically, here it's when I'm referring to truth, it's more the factual truth. It's to know basic events, who has been, what kind of, I don't know, unit in the army has arrested someone, where the bodies lie, things like that. But in the same time, I have to recognize it's still very difficult. Myself, to take a very simple example, I happen to be one of the first people to arrive at the scene of a massacre in a few years ago. There are other journalists who came, and we had different perspectives, to such an extent that now there are books written about our different perspectives. And we were almost all there in the same time, and we cannot agree on basic facts. Yes, sometimes it could be very tricky. Yeah, I agree with you. I don't have any clear answer than that, but I can tell you that it's much more easy to know what lie is than truth is. And I think there are a lot of expectations about certain events, and that sometimes we can have pretty good ideas about to be closer to the events, at least. But there is still a process of reconstruction, yes.
I'm going to jump in and just ask you to try to push you a little bit farther on that, because you talked about one of the measures being the success in building a common narrative. And I'm wondering if there's space for building joint narratives that might be distinct rather than one common narrative.
I don't, but actually more and more I'm moving from the idea of a common narrative. What I think the most important thing is to create some kind of different memories which can coexist peacefully together. And maybe in the long run, some kind of common narrative will emerge, but I'm not sure that it's even very important. I'm very struck by the work of an Israeli and Palestinian psychologist. They have created a book which is divided into three parts. One is the Israeli historical narrative. The other one is the Palestinian historical narrative. And the most important part is in between, and it's a white space. It's for you. You to write what you want in between and create your own narrative. So I think maybe if there is some hope, is in this white space.
Okay. So I think we have Paul and Albakir.
Well, I join Paul Rui, Religion and Peacemaking. Thank you very much for this thank you for mentioning the example of Billy Brandt in front of the Warsaw ghetto, because to my thinking, that moment, even without words, did more to bring healing, reconciliation, and hope than a thousand speeches or documents or books. That was a turning point moment. But as you say, the right moment has to be seized. My question you've already touched on, but if the ultimate goal is, let's assume it is, it's not altogether sure, the healing of a nation, reconciliation, hope, return to rule of law, etc. Is this at all possible without naming? Is it possible if impunity has been declared a precondition? I think of Guatemala as an example.
I don't know Guatemala, but what I think is your point is right. I think at one, what is maybe interesting is even if a commission has a very limited mandate, and that's maybe Judy's point, what is very interesting is to which extent this limited amount of clarification of the past might engineer some kind of social reaction. If it does, then something will be moving within the society. It's like in Morocco, because there are no naming, but at the same time, there have been these unofficial hearings where the naming was, they did say the names, then it changed things. So here again, I think we have to pay attention to the mandates, but also we have to pay more attention to the social dynamics which are engineered. And I think that's the reason.
Baki Mukhtar, USIP. Thanks for the excellent presentation. My question is based on Dan's comment and your response to it. I thought you will have a definite answer for Dan's question or comment. And I'm surprised why there is no answer as to whether these commissions help peace building or not. And if there isn't, I think then you could easily include into your framework as an impact assessment part of it, so that we could know whether this helped the peace building or not. This is the first part. The other is, I think the context or the environment in which these commissions are created or were created determines their effectiveness. And the context is determined by the balance of power on the ground between the two conflicting parties. So if we have the perpetrators of or the opposite still in power, then this is obviously going to affect the outcome of the commission and become bigger, everything that you talk about. And if the other way around, then it will be effective. In the case of the fairest possibility, then I don't think victims of these crimes, they just, you know, have to wait for time to go, and then after one or two generations, there will be, you know, conscious awakening like what happened in Germany, and probably after decades or so, the truth will be there. Otherwise,
To come back to Dan's point, once again, I think potentially they could be useful for peace building, but I just want to be careful because once again, these institutions they can really work if there is some kind of social dynamics which is in turn engineered by them. Otherwise, they would have limited effects. So we have really to look at the society, and if there is a clear interaction between the two, I think they could play a very positive role.
I think Albert Kay's point is a very important one, that when you have a regime that has survived in whole or in part, Serbia is a good example, they actually appointed a truce commission. It was a total failure. Total failure. But what were they trying to do? They were trying to use this soft mechanism to avoid justice. That's what they were trying to do. And they have essentially avoided justice. It seems to me that that makes an enormous difference, and that the exploitation of some of these mechanisms, I don't know Morocco well enough, but I gather there's some element of exploitation of the truth and reconciliation idea for purposes of continuity of the regime, seems to me that that's not going to be a very happy situation for justice.
Yeah, but at the same time, you're taking the example of a truth commission which totally failed, with some good people inside. They decided to leave because they didn't think it was a credible commission. And so, that's the whole point I was trying to make today. This commission could be manipulated, could be distorted, could be ineffective. Yes, that's true. And it's what happened with Serbia, granted. But you have other cases where it has been different, and it has changed things. So we need to have this kind of nuanced approach. And I think that there is something more than pure tribunals. If tribunal can work, that's great. I have no problem with that. But sometimes you need, but then you can address only a very limited number of cases, and it won't be enough, and a lot of people will feel very frustrated. And I think sometimes it is important to have some kind of dramatic event, some kind of pedagogic event. And I understand that trials are these didactic moments, but especially for a nation building. But I think public hearings could also be that moment. So we need to see sometimes a kind of combination. I don't see anymore as antagonistic like in the mid-90s, where it was either South Africa or the CTY. Sierra Leone demonstrated that we can have both in the same time.
I think we're going to close today's session with that, but I invite you to continue talking among yourselves and giving feedback and continuing conversation with Pierre as he develops this project. Thank you for coming. We do have the next project report will be next Thursday at the same time and place on training for diversity, religious issues in U.S. military operations with Senior Fellow Charlotte Hunter, and we hope that you'll be able to come back for that. Thanks again for coming.